A meritorious act, this is implied in what we have already said. Certainly, all acts of conjugal life are bearers of divine life, if they are accomplished according to the order of grace, and it would be wrong to see in physical union a kind of privileged instance of married life. Acts of the soul, even if they be limited to the soul, can have still greater value, and those who practice periodic continence imposed upon them by circumstances of life, know that their love deepens through the Christian virtue of sacrifice freely consented to. But it remains true that all the spiritual horizons are opened on the conjugal act which is thus subordinated to the total Christian life. There is no such thing as an indifferent act, let us repeat. Where many married couples find an occasion to wallow in the sensual, others, penetrated by charity and desirous of living in fidelity to their consecrated love, find a new motive as well as a possible occasion of spiritual progress and love of God. Such a purified outlook, a will stripped of all egoism, and such a sense of the high vocation of love is not obtained immediately. The ambient of the world is so opposed to such a state of soul, and the poor human body is prey to such solicitations and excitations in the pagan surroundings of our society, that here to a slow education and progressive conquest of the human by grace is called for. It is a great comfort to know that the soul and the will do not depend upon their own efforts for success. More important than their efforts is the total confidence they place in the work of divine life. Insensibly, under the effect of the sacraments and the general merits of Christian life, the evangelization of the flesh will take place, the discouragements and deceptions will give way to the joy of those who know that God is with them. For it is God who heals and saves. Continence. Side by side with physical union, there is a place in married life for continence, either because of the human rhythm of love or because exterior circumstances impose it. In the past few years, the gravity of these circumstances has grown frighteningly. It may be a question of impaired health or difficulties of the material and economic order that oblige many homes to face seriously the problem of birth limitation. In the interest of home life, the equilibrium of the wife and mother, the education of the children, a certain family policy is most desirable. But it supposes, if it is not to lead many parents directly into sin and, finally, a state of habitual sin, a good deal of generosity and a Christian sense of values constantly nourished at the wellsprings of grace. There are three possible attitudes in this matter. Either the laws of conjugal chastity are ignored, and our present-day society, profoundly corrupt, usually chooses this way out, or continence is observed in a slavish manner, temporarily, because one of the partners senses the opposition of the other to conjugal deception. In this case, the sacrifice does not bear all of its fruit, or, third, a more or less prolonged sacrifice takes on a positive character and finds its justification and its end in the broad spiritual perspective offered by the Christian doctrine of marriage. For continence makes a cross, and when we speak of the cross, we speak in the same breath of progress and life. Let us see, in effect, how continence, freely accepted and not grudgingly borne, can, far from opposing or smothering it, serve love. Those who profit by it are first of all, let us not hesitate to say, the children. Participating in the work of creation when physical union is possible and desirable, Christian husbands and wives must also participate in the work of redemption. The periods of sacrifice born and offered for the salvation of these little ones with which God has blessed their union, will permit the parents to give birth as it were to the souls that have been confided to them. Why not think of the words of Saint Paul, I fill up in my flesh what is lacking to the passion of Christ, for his body which is the church. Our children are our own, but they are also the church's. We have the power of taking part in their redemption by virtue of the discipline which we impose on our bodies. A child must not be the fruit of a fulfilled love only, for, body and soul, he solicits the paternity and maternity of a love freely sacrificed. The parents themselves will also profit by continence. There is nothing more harmful than habit, If we give this word the sense of routine, continence is the savor of love which frequent and instinctive use of marital rites tends to deaden, even though we may not be aware of it. There is about love a certain quality of wholeness which physical union tends to obliterate. If experience proves that married people have too little in common, it is because the union of spirit and soul, which is the supreme mode of union, is too seldom attained by them. It is good that, by nature, by circumstances of life or by the exigencies of grace, this sacrifice be made in the name of love as a means of seeking in the soul new kinds of expression and new depths. Many couples have thus experienced that this separation will not isolate them but on the contrary unite them the more intimately. But to be positive, continence must be accepted. We have already said this and we insist upon it. That is why the forces of love in this matter, as everywhere else, call forth the mysterious and inexhaustible resources of grace. What may appear humanly insurmountable becomes, if not easy, at least possible to those who recall our Savior's words, "Without me you can do nothing." The evidence of experience is conclusive. Deprived of the assistance of the sacraments, of prayer, of an apostolic life, of the gift of self in all of its forms, the efforts of husband and wife will remain for the most part ineffective. If the whole Christian life is not based on the human foundation of goodwill, it must necessarily wane under the pressure of instinct and the influence of a corrupt society. If then continence appears useful, even necessary, in any conjugal life, something must be done to prepare for it. The cruel struggles of conscience that ravage so many homes that wish to respect the law of God can be explained in part by the lack of preparation for sacrifice and generosity. In the Middle Ages, the Church drew the attention of young couples to this on their wedding day. The texts of certain rituals provide evidence of this. The celebrated formula according to which all is permitted in marriage has played havoc with the education of many engaged persons. Every state of life supposes renouncement. Every state of life must practice some asceticism. Every state of life that leads a redeemed sinner to eternal life must be marked with the sign of the cross. If young people can see continence as one of the positive conditions for the fruitfulness of their love, they will not wait for the imperious counsel of circumstance. In an act of mutual accord, they will impose upon themselves the generosities which Christian conscience asks of them. They will no longer consider as unpleasant demands of an inhuman morality that which, visibly, gives depth and fulfillment to their love. Part E. This is a great mystery. The sacrament of marriage, vocation to sanctity, fidelity in all things, the mystery of marriage. Chapter VEI. The sacrament of marriage. Throughout Christendom, young couples are calling, and their cry is a veritable sign of our times. What do they want? Dedicated to their faith, but also to themselves in their love, they are in search of a conjugal sanctity, that is to say a sanctity that develops in the peace and trials of married life. They want to understand this sanctity as well as live it. This effort of laymen to base their faith on intelligence, their spirituality on dogma, is again a sign of the times. They insist, "Teach us the revealed doctrine that is the basis of family spirituality. We want to be nourished by truth and not by poetry. Bring us the teaching of Christ and of the Church. We ask no more, but we ask no less." We will try to answer them. We admit that our task is not an easy one. In the first place, we have to reckon with the influence of theology manuals. Preoccupied primarily with defending the institution of the Church against outside detractors and with recalling Christian couples to the necessary minimum of sanctity, they have been more concerned with sociology and morality than with spirituality and dogma. They respond only imperfectly to the call of young couples and frequently limit themselves to tracing the general principles of Christian perfection without answering the real question: what relation is there between human love and the love of God? Second, we come up against another, more serious difficulty. one that arises from the very nature of the subject we are treating. If marriage contains something of the divine, if it is a link between God and man, it is therefore a mystery. It is impossible to sift it through the sieve of human intelligence. However well-reasoned our analysis might be, it can never reach that element which is super-rational, supernatural. For beyond all explanation will stretch a no man's land, a divine darkness, to borrow an expression from the mystics, that reason will never be able to break through, and where only prayer has the right to venture. But this interdiction must not discourage us unduly. A closed road is not the same as a dead end. It should rather invite us to pass from reflection to contemplation. God alone speaks well of God. And God has told us something of this mystery. This revelation is found totally condensed in this short sentence, so apparently simple and unified: marriage is a sacrament. This is the case in which is enclosed the pearl without price. Let us open it, for it contains more riches than all the names the imagination of men have showered upon the word love. I. Marriage is a grace of Christ. What is a sacrament? It is first of all an act of Christ. Behind the rites, the objects and the formulae with which each generation has enriched, sometimes overburdened, the liturgy of the sacraments, behind the face of this priest, whose human idiosyncrasies and imperfections are only too obvious, behind all of this stands another who blesses, who absolves, who consecrates. The person of the minister is effaced and disappears when he confers the sacrament. His dignity or indignity is then of small consequence. Christ uses this instrument, still clogged with the earth of creation, as formerly he used the mud of the roadside or the water of the river. Saint Augustine, in a striking contrast, declared apropos of baptism, whether Peter baptizes or whether Judas baptizes, it is Christ who baptizes. And so it is of marriage. Two people draw close to each other. They join hands. They join their souls and their lives. What are they? A strange mixture of aspirations and instincts, a confusion of stray impulses and weaknesses. What do they give each other? Their humanity such as it is, their life such as it will be, something halfway between good and evil. Those who stand by and who have had some experience of life smile in pity at their illusions. They know that life is capable of dissipating even the grandest of dreams. And they would be right were a third person not present. For Christ himself seals the union of these two creatures. Every marriage, as every sacrament, is conferred by Christ. It doesn't matter whether the officiating priest be a bishop or an unknown curate, for Christ marries the young couple and they themselves are his ministers. From that moment onwards everything changes. This human union, this love of clay, is taken in hand by our blessed Lord himself. In the struggles of each day, against everything that threatens their intimacy, the couple will be sustained by another force, the very force that sustains the world in space, because it is also the creative force of their wills and of their love. The strength with which I love you, says Claudius Prus, is no different from that by which you exist. God has destined these two people for one another. The day on which they promise themselves to each other, he declares solemnly that such is indeed his will and that henceforward he will be at their side in the battle of life. The luminous shadow of this mystery envelops the entire lifespan of the husband and wife. Christ is not only into them, but in them. It is from the interior that he wishes to purify and ennoble every moment of their married life. Theologians speak of their strict right to the graces of their state, but let us not be deceived by this legal vocabulary that only touches the surface of the reality. This right is more than a certitude. It is a presence, it is God at work in their lives. It is difficult to elaborate in detail upon these graces which Christ offers in incessant abundance to Christian families. They are as varied as the days that pass and the love that grows. We can, however, indicate their principal forms. Grace of purification. Christ brings to marriage first of all a grace of purification. When we speak to the engaged of purifying their love, they are much surprised.